Okay, welcome back to the podcast. This is episode number 145 with my guest, Sarah Kirkland Snyder. Sarah is a composer. She also runs New Amsterdam Records. She founded it and is running it with her friends. And I've known her in the soap percussion world as a composer for a while now through various channels, but never really got to know her that well. And I wanted to. So I reached out. She was very generous and said, of course. And so I had a really lovely chat with Sarah, and I hope you enjoy listening to it. I always love getting to chat with people at length for like the first time and really breaking the seal. It's really fun, and I can't wait to do it again soon. So I hope you enjoy this. Again, this is Sarah Kirkland Snyder. Talk to you soon. Bye. Well, okay. As I was getting ready for this chat, Sarah, I was having a couple thoughts. I had this huge wave of anxiety because I realized, like, you've been in our circle, I've been in your circle, we've crossed paths a million times. This may be the longest you and I have ever chatted face to face. And I was like, oh my God. And then I was like, is it Sarah Snyder? Is it Sarah Kirkland Snyder? And I was like, I don't know this person. What am I doing? Which is also not
completely, are you serious?
It's not completely true. I do know you, but
and you gave me percussion lessons, remember, at Yale?
Oh, that's right.
Way back in the day. But we were both so sleep deprived that, like, I remember literally, and this is no comment on your teaching or anything. Please. I was just so sleep deprived. I remember getting sleepy as you were, like I was standing there and you were showing me a symbol or something. And I was like getting narcoleptic.
Well, I mean, so, I am confident that studying the symbol is not the most sort of like, you know, exciting. I'm with you.
It was not that. It was just, deeply sleep deprived.
Well, I think, is it Sarah Kirkland Snyder or Sarah Snyder? What do you prefer?
I mean, professionally, I use the Kirkland because when I was first starting out, there was another Sarah Snyder composer. So I felt like I needed to differentiate. But you can call me whatever. It doesn't matter.
we'll just say Sarah for now. But actually, it's interesting you bring up our time at Yale. I don't have as big a memory about that snare drum or that cymbal lesson, but it would make sense that I bored someone to sleep, especially a grad school friend.
It was not you.
My first time I think you and I crossed paths in my head was at a New Music New Haven rehearsal in the percussion studio. And we were premiering a piece of yours. I was bowing a vibraphone and Steve was conducting.
Oh, right.
And you were...
Right, because... Right. Okay. The conductor who was on the project like got sick or something and I needed a replacement at the last minute.
I didn't know the backstory as to why Steve was up there conducting all of a sudden. But I'm just like I don't know if it was my first or second year at Yale, but I was just like, I'm nervous. I'm back here. And, you know, the composer's in the room and Steve Mackey's conducting. What is going on with my life? What every decision in my world, in my life has led me to this moment. What's happening? And Steve stopped and he's like, Josh, boy. I think, or he says vibraphone. And I was like, you know, my name is Josh. He's like, Josh, I think you need to bow the vibraphone way louder. And you sort of like stepped up and you tapped him on the shoulder and you're like, actually, could it be softer? And he's like, sure. And that happened about five times in the rehearsal, but it was all about my bowing. Like every time Steve had a thought about my bowing, you were like, he's doing what I wanted him to do.
And that's so amazing. And that's a great story.
Anyway, I don't come to these podcasts with many prepared questions other than to sort of like be like, hey, do you remember this? And tell me a little bit more about, tell me more about what led you to that point prior to me meeting you.
Yeah. That's so funny. Gosh, I hadn't thought about that in a long time. I just remember it was like a last minute panic to find a conductor and Steve was already visiting. So I was like, will you just do this? And looking back, I think maybe that wasn't probably, anyway, it was fine, but it was a little awkward. It's a little awkward. At the time when you're like, I just want, you know, you're thinking about the exigencies and the needs of making the best performance. And you're like, my boyfriend's here and he's a great conductor. Like I wasn't thinking of him as Steve Mackey or, you know, anybody that would make anyone else in the room uncomfortable. But anyway,
this was also pre,
like, it was all okay.
This was pre internet, like, or pre like Facebook and stuff. So it's not like,
right.
I mean, I had only heard stories about, you know, I only knew of Steve. There was a marimba solo called See a Thursday that was popular in the percussion world.
Yes.
And then so when somebody was just like, you walk in the room and Steve Mackey, and I was like, who's that guy? And somebody's like, that's Steve Mackey. It's like,
I don't know who Steve is. There's no Facebook. I can't look on Instagram to see him singing these charming songs in the kitchen with you all like he does now. But anyway, so what for you, I'm curious to go back to like when you were a kid, what got you into music in the first place? And then sort of how did that morph into composing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. A lot of my earliest memories are musical. I was really fascinated by music and I was singing all the time. Apparently it was such an annoying habit of mine that my parents liked it, but whenever they would have this babysitter come over, she would get really annoyed and she finally weaned me off of that singing while eating habit. And my parents were very upset, but, I would show up for show and tell and sing rather than present something. I was always making up tunes and I told my parents that I wanted to learn the piano. And we didn't have a piano at the time. And my parents were like struggling to put two and two together, could not afford a piano. So I would go over to my neighbor's house who had a piano and she allowed me to use her piano for lessons for a couple years. So I would go over there and practice like almost every day. And this awesome woman, so nice of her to do this. And so that's how I started piano lessons. And then eventually my grandparents shipped us up their piano from North Carolina and I could get that much more serious about it. And then I started taking cello and playing guitar and singing in choirs and stuff like that. And piano was always my main instrument, but I played chamber music like with cello. I went to these summer camps, music camps at the American Boy Choir School, which used to be in Princeton, and they had a co-ed summer camp. So I learned how to like play with other musicians. I really loved that. And I sang a ton of music. Yeah, it was just my favorite thing as a kid.
I want to go back to your babysitter for a second. And I want to give your babysitter the benefit of the doubt here for 2 seconds, but I want to hear your side of the story. Were you a singer who had like a scarf wrapped around their neck all the time and carried a water bottle around and sang at the top of their lungs all the time? Was that the type of singer you were? I'm married to a singer, so I can ask that question.
Like the humidity level is not right here.
Yeah, if you were that sort of singer, I could understand why she's like, why don't we talk about the piano?
No, I was not that kind of singer at all. I don't know what kind of singer I was. I've never been like, I have a fine, very boring sort of choir boy voice. It wasn't ever about, it was just like singing little quiet melodies to myself. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned that I want to talk about how you got into composing, but that rings a bell to me. Like you mentioned something at SOCI when you were talking to our students about one of the ways that you compose now, as compared to maybe 10 years ago when the cell phone wasn't a thing and you couldn't just record, that you're constantly singing into your phone and recording little melodies as you are, like if you're out walking or you're doing something where you don't have your piano or Sibelius handy. And
yeah,
you know, when I listen to a ton of podcasts of like comedians in particular, and when I hear them talk about process, they do the exact same thing. You know, they're out for a walk, they think of a premise for a joke, and it's like every comedian, the ones that are the dirtiest and the foulest to the one to Jerry Seinfeld, like the process is the same. And I think, and I don't do that. I wish I did. And, you know, but I'm curious for you, like where to tie that back to how you got into composing, at what point in your life you were like, I want to make something, I want to make music that doesn't already exist. Where did that seed start to, who planted that seed for you?
It's a really good question because I don't think anybody planted it. It was like, as soon as I started learning music at the piano, I would have ideas for how else it should go. I would hear some other line or I would want it to go in another direction. And so, in talking about walking and hearing music, I walked a lot as a kid because I had a really long walk to the bus stop. It was like several streets away. So every morning when I was walking to school, I would be making up music. I would just be hearing tunes in my head and singing them. And they were just I don't know, probably derived from different tunes I was either playing, you know, at the time at piano, or things I'd heard in movies. My parents did not listen to classical music. They only played pop music. So at home, I was hearing like everything from the Beatles to Billy Joel and Fleetwood Mac and Olivia Newton-John and like Juice Newton and Captain and Tennille and all this like really bad 70s stuff.
You bite your tongue. Really, that's great. Not bad stuff. I feel like when I was old enough,
I loved it.
I negotiated with my parents to stay. They had a card night every Thursday, and it was also the night where like Cheers was on. And so their friends would come over. They'd have the table with the green felt, and they'd all have the like the see-through green billed caps, and they're playing cards. You know, my job. Really? I negotiated to stay up past 8 p.m. if I could man the record player, and so I would flip the bill, and it was Billy Joel, Uptown Girl. And I would just, I just flipped it every 33 and a half minutes, whatever it was. Yeah. I would just flip and just watch Cheers. And that was like every Thursday night over the summers. God. Cause my mom
that's
was a school
great
teacher.
Visual. So, wow. That's anyway, a great visual. Yeah.
I have a soft spot for that music.
Me too. Oh, for sure. And my dad was like a huge music lover, and he was just constantly playing these records and singing along and like drumming his fingers on the tabletops and, you know, so that's, I think a lot of my obsession with melody and phrasing comes from all of that music that I heard as a kid, that pop music, you know, that sort of was the fundamental DNA. And then the classical stuff I got from my lessons and my teachers and my classical studies. So when I was walking around like to the bus stop or whatever, it was sort of a melding of these different worlds in my head. It was these endless tunes, but they were often, you know, just very hooky. Cause like that's what all of that music had in common, was that there was always a central melody, a central hook. And yeah, I was fascinated by that.
Well, who, you mentioned that your teachers and your lessons kind of turned you on to classical music. When did you, I mean, I know that it wasn't like one time one person planted a seed, but
Yeah.
At some point you had to make, you had to have like a phone call where it's like, can I set up a lesson with you? Like when did that happen? And what was your sort of like the big revelation that you walked? I mean, I remember sometimes in grad school, I took a class in grad school called the History of Jazz between 1969 and 1971. Right. And it was this Michael Veal. Do you know that guy?
Yeah,
he taught in the department, the undergrad department, and it was just like the history, like a very tiny sliver of history. And I walked out of that class every day being like, why did nobody tell me about this? Like, what's wrong with you people? Like, I'd walk up to Paul Hawkshaw and I'd be like, no, Bruckner's great, but do you know In a Silent Way? Are you out of your mind, Paul Hawkshaw? So for you, like when you walk out of, when you went into that first lesson, what was your, how to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long sort of convoluted story, because there wasn't like an exact aha moment, but I remember writing a piece on my own when I was like 9 or 10, and I brought it to my piano teacher, and she was wonderful, very like a very supportive piano teacher, but for whatever reason, she listened to the piece and she said, well, it breaks all these rules, and that was what she said. And I felt like I had done something wrong and that it was a failure. And so I was like, oh, and I remember I sort of like cried about it afterwards. And I thought, I don't know what these rules are. What are these rules? And what are the rules for? And who cares? Like, what, you know, what is this all about? Part of me was like, who cares? Part of me was like, I want to figure out the rules so I can. So
you're also young enough that you don't realize that rules are also relative. Like the
right, like exactly.
My dad had to fire somebody whenever he was a boss and at some place. And when I was really young, about the same age, he came home and he told my mom he had to fire somebody, and he was really upset about it. And I was like, my dad set someone on fire. Like I had no idea that like fire was anything different. My brain was not able to understand that those are two different
exactly,
things.
Exactly.
So you broke the rules, and you're like, people go to jail for that. You know, what
would I do? Totally. Totally. And I was like, are these rules of like physical sound? Is it like, am I offending some sound barriers or like some acoustic, you know, laws? Or is this like rules of taste? I really had no idea what she was talking about. Later, I realized she was talking about parallel, you know, the piece I'd written was very tonal, and she was talking about parallel fifths and parallel octaves. really not probably the most helpful thing to tell a 9-year-old kid who's making a foray into composition. But anyway, so it took me a while to work my nerve back up to show my music to anybody else. And that was like in high school when I was taking piano lessons from this other wonderful piano teacher, Lori Altman, who's this amazing. He was like a legendary figure in Princeton when I was in high school. He taught tons of piano lessons and everybody loved him. He was very sort of jazz oriented and pop oriented. I did not study jazz with him. Or when I say pop oriented, I mean like he knew how to talk to kids and be like, what kind of music do you like? You know, and I would say like Simon and Garfunkel and the Beatles. And he would bring me a bunch of that as well as Debussy that related to the Simon and Garfunkel or the James Taylor or whatever it was. Right. So he was really good at sort of like uniting classical and non-classical traditions and helping you see the commonalities. And so because of that, I felt comfortable enough to show him this piano piece that I was writing, which was totally a cross between like early Debussy, Claire de Lune, and Joni Mitchell, more towards Joni Mitchell. Mm-hmm. And I was obsessed with Joni Mitchell for a while in high school. So, so he was very supportive and he helped me, like we talked a lot about the piece and he sort of started giving me composition lessons, but that was pretty close to right before I left high school. So I didn't have that much time to really study with him. Mm-hmm. It was more like theory that he was teaching me. So when I talk about my first composition lesson, I really feel like I can't talk about, I have to talk about what I had when I was 25, because mm-hmm. that was really my first serious composition lesson. So between high school and 25, there was, you know, college and this whole chunk of time where I thought of composition as something that I just did for myself, you know, but I wasn't thinking of it as a viable career path.
Can I ask you, I don't mean to interrupt, but was it, I think there's something, I don't want to say everybody, I had a similar experience in college, both in my undergrad and my graduate studies, where there was a lot of stuff I was doing that I felt wasn't a viable career path. Playing steel drum gigs. You know, I was like studying orchestra excerpts because in school, in the conservatory, that was the easiest path that you could lay out in a syllabus, for example. Like,
yeah.
The same thing goes for college professors. Like, if you want to do that job, there's boxes you can check, right?
And exactly.
If you're teaching, you can give that to students, but that also gives students the impression that that's the only path.
Exactly.
I had those same moments of insecurity, and it's funny to me that you went through your entire schooling, most of your schooling, and the thing that was your science project growing fur in the fridge is now the thing you're doing for a living. And I'm curious, yeah. Like how do you, I feel like you used your sort of, not your weakness, but the thing no one wanted to talk about, you use that as your superpower now. And I'm curious if you can talk about, give advice to students now who are in that position, having those exact same fears that both you and I have experienced in one way.
Yeah. I mean, I really put it off until I couldn't put it off anymore. Like music was always there. It was always something I loved to do. And it was always nagging at me in the back of my mind. But I didn't know of any living composers. You know, this is like my first couple years in college. I started college in Middlebury, Vermont. Didn't have a particularly strong music program. I was not considering music at all as a career at that point in time. You know, I had no idea who Philip Glass or Meredith Monk or Steve Reich were, let alone like Stravinsky and a lot of composers from the 20th century. You know, all the classical music I knew was what I'd been taught in orchestra, playing the cello and in piano lessons. And so basically went up to like Debussy and that was it, you know, if that in piano at least, but in cello, it was like, you know, up to Tchaikovsky and that was it. And so there was this whole world of music I didn't know. And I kind of thought that I did sort of think about film scoring because, you know, I knew that there were people writing music for films and I thought maybe I could try to do that, but that also didn't seem like a viable career option. Like what, you know, what does that even mean? And I was a female and I didn't know of any female composers and it just seemed like this very far flung possibility. And so also, yeah, like you're sort of taught that there are these conventional career paths that you're supposed to take, like doctor, lawyer, teacher, whatever, you know? And so I was concerned about making a living, and I was thinking about like, oh, I should become a lawyer and then I can support my music with my legal work or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, in your mind, you're thinking that you can do it all. So I graduated from college with a degree in sociology and psychology. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to go into law, like public policy work, or counseling, like psychology. Mm-hmm. But I still wasn't thinking of music as a career, as a viable career option. I moved to New York, and I got a job working for the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy, which is a sort of nonprofit law firm, as it were. They handle reproductive rights cases. And I was working as like a paralegal for a couple of years there. And at the same time, I had a bunch of friends from college who were involved in theater, and they were doing theater productions on the Lower East Side. Mm-hmm. And they asked me to do music for them. They knew that I wrote music for fun on the side. So I started writing music for these performances, and I loved it. It was just the most satisfying way I could spend my time. And I was resenting my law job more and more and feeling like, if I could just have more time to do this, you know, I could only write at nights and on the weekends, and it wasn't enough time. I also wanted to take classes and learn more about how to become a better composer. I wanted to get better technically. And mm-hmm. so I started asking my boss if I could take some unpaid days off. I was like, can I just have a couple more days off? And she's like, Sarah, that's not the way a job works. So I started realizing that, you know, I needed to fully transfer my energy to music and commit to it and take this scary leap. So I did that, and I talked to my parents about it. You know, I'd saved up a little bit of money, but not that much. And so, you know, they were sort of a safety net, but really what I did was I got a job waitressing and also doing temp work. So I quit my law job and I got a bunch of other jobs at cafes and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I used that to support myself while I was taking classes at NYU and Juilliard and Manhattan School of Music, trying to cobble together a music BA. Hmm. And I started working with the composer, Justin Della Gioia, at that time, who is a wonderful teacher. And he really, he was my first composition teacher. So that was age 25.
Wow.
And then 4 years later, I wound up at Yale. So it was, you know, but I started Yale for grad school at age 29. Yeah. So I was like relatively old compared to the other students.
What would you say is some of the, like, as you started studying and learning about craft and learning also that, I don't know, I'll speak for myself, most everything that you learn, you realize there's a process. Like, you don't learn something, like, you don't be, like, learn about, you know, parallel octaves, and then it's just like, got it.
Yeah.
Like, no, you write, you know, 40 orchestra pieces, and then you realize you go through and you place those parallel octaves where you want them, and you do that 3,500 times until you get really good at it. Like,
yes,
that's how Bach did it. That's why Bach only does it a few times. He breaks his own rules because he knows his own rules. Like,
yes.
And I'm curious for you, as you started to learn the rules and learn that they were relative now, and that it's like, oh, wait a minute, you know, Debussy broke his own rules, and so does David Lang, and so does Caroline Shaw, and I'll bet so do you. What were some of the crutches you realized you were using as a composer, and where did you learn your soft underbelly was and that you had to shore it up with more craft and more process?
Oh, that's a really good question.
And I asked that, sorry, I don't want to, it sounds like I have an agenda to be like, what are you shittiest at? That's not at all what I'm saying. Like,
for me,
what was the thing that you helped you realize, like, oh, if I work on this, actually it makes all the other things way better. For me, that's what I mean by crutch.
Yeah. Well, so when I first started out, with studying with Justin Della Gioia, like, all of my music, it was limited by my technical knowledge and my awareness of different kinds of music. I tended to write sort of this post-minimal sort of, I mean, I love post-minimalism. I'm not saying that in a in a pejorative way remotely, but for me, I felt stuck. It was like everything was, I was doing the same things over and over. And I felt like I was making choices based on limitations or limitations in my brain rather than choice. So, or desire. So Justin suggested all of these different exercises to get me to open up my harmonic sensibility, my sense of range of instruments, my, because on the piano, I was like working within this 1.5 octave. I just kept writing everything in this one register. And so we were just trying to open things up. And, you know, we started studying lots of old music and lots of new music, like Bach to Lutoslawski, and looking at aleatoric, I mean, looking at all this music that just blew my mind because I hadn't thought about music that way. Mm-hmm. So that was really intimidating and really scary and hard, but also amazing and open, mind opening and thrilling. And so it became hard for me to write though for a while. Like I felt so intimidated by all the repertoire, and it also became clear that a lot of 20th century music was very preoccupied with making scores look very virtuosic on the page, and this sort of virtuosity in the music that was this, a lot of complexity and a lot of, and of course, Justin did have his own proclivities. So he was not discussing like bang on a can music with me and Meredith Monk and Philip Glass and Steve Reich. So I was really just learning like, you know, Ligeti and a lot of sort of the, and Boulez and some of the ideas of modernism, and, a lot of that felt, just not like my home. And so that was something I had to work through. But you know, Justin was very concerned with teaching me the basics of counterpoint, and, counterpoint really became an anchor for me. It sort of got me out of thinking about style and just got me to think about line and form and music more technically in a way that allowed me to still feel like I was being expressive personally.
Is there a piece,
that makes sense.
It totally does. Yeah. I mean, is there a piece from your earlier period before like your blue period, when you, that you look back on, you're like, actually, I kind of nailed that. Like every once in a while, you sort of hit one out of the park and you're not sure how you did it. Like, is there something pre lesson Sarah where you're like, I don't know how I did it, but yeah, put that one on a record. Let's do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wrote this string quartet, like in 1999 or 2000, that was like the big piece that I wrote to try to get into graduate school. And I spent 2 years working on it with Justin, and I was really proud of it. You know, I listen to it now and it sounds like there are parts that are overwritten, or I feel like I'm trying too hard. But it's also the sound of a young composer who loves music so much and is trying to figure stuff out. And there are a lot of things in there that I wouldn't write today, but there's also a lot of stuff in there that's just very, very me. And I listen to it and I'm proud of it, and I'm glad that I wrote it.
I think it's important that for me personally, I mean, everybody should do what they're more comfortable with, but I think it's really important for composers, for anybody who's conserving things like a conservatory, a library, whatever. Like I'm looking at the shelf of books behind you, and Chopin and like all, you know, Handel's Messiah and all this other, like we've conserved those, right?
We've
conserved the idea of the sonata. I'm seeing a sonata form book on your shelf.
Yeah.
But the problem with conservation sometimes is that you, in order to conserve a set of rules, you have to cleave out the parts that you don't study the excerpts where Bach breaks his rules.
Right.
And for me, I don't think I genuinely don't believe it's a malicious act that somebody was like, no, let's take this out. This will really screw everybody up later. Like, I think it's just an attempt to be like, no, this makes the rules clearer, and we have to teach a bunch of undergrads who can barely get out of bed anyway. Like,
yeah,
But on the other hand, it makes Bach not seem like a messy person. It doesn't. Yeah. It makes him less complicated. And I'm like, no. The dude had like how many kids? Like,
yeah, I'm 24. Sorry.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. It's like, can you imagine? Like, there were how many Zoom meetings was Bach like? Hold on a second. I need a few more minutes. Like, I have 23 kids. Like, I wish. I think, totally. And I think for you, it's important. It's important to me to like see Sarah as like a tree that grows and be able to look at those rings on the inner and be like, oh wow, that's the year where X, Y, and Z happened. That's why that music looks and sounds the way it does. And so I'm always disappointed when I see composers who are like, you're not, I want that piece stricken from the record. I'm like, well, that nothing else in nature gets to make that call.
Totally. Like, totally. Yeah. No, I feel the same way. I mean, I have some early pieces that are embarrassing, but also what we think is embarrassing is not necessarily embarrassing to somebody else. Or like last year, I just had this piece performed by Nick Fan, that this wonderful singer, Nick Fan, who performed this piece that I wrote, you know, during that theater time that I was talking about earlier. And it's so early. And I was like laughing at the idea because he was like, I just need an a cappella. He's like, I love your music. I just want an a cappella, you know. Do you have anything like that? I was like, well, I do, but it's from 1997 and, you know, it's really embarrassing. Mm. And I sent it to him just for kicks. And he was like, I love this, you know? So you just never know. Right. Like, to me, it's something that feels very vulnerable making isn't necessarily, I don't know, doesn't necessarily make you vulnerable. You know what I mean?
Right. And so, you don't know how it could help someone else. I mean, I was helped immensely the day that I discovered Bach did parallel octaves. Like, and if there's some student out there, you know, like the Aaron Bush's, the Young Women's Composers Camp that came to SOCI and you all spoke with him. Like, if one of those students is like, sees a piece of yours and they're like, oh, I did that. Oh, okay. Whew. Like if there's sense of anxiety is just deflated a little bit, like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think this is a huge part of why it's important for composers to listen to all kinds of, like, so much different music, because you'll see stuff that surprises you and you're like, oh, it's okay to do that. Okay. Yeah. Good to know.
Yeah. And also some of your brilliant ideas that you think are original, like as far as we're like, so is concerned, it's like, man, Merce Cunningham and John Cage did that in like 1938. Like, like we're here with I got a loop pedal. Look at me, you know. Let me jump ahead a little bit. To talk about your recent work and to tie it back to your singing as a kid. Like I picture some of your most substantial works as being with Sharonova and working with singers. And I'm just curious if you would be willing. You don't have to talk specifically about any one project, but if you would talk a little bit about your work with Shara and how you're writing for the voice worked with those projects and with Shara in particular.
Yeah, sure. So Penelope started as a theater piece, that was written for Ellen McLaughlin, this wonderful playwright and actress, actor, I should say. And she had asked me to write the music for this monodrama where she was going to be, Penelope, sort of looking at the story of how she dealt with waiting for Odysseus to return to home, or to return to himself or some form of himself. And, we had done this theater project together and I really enjoyed working with her on that. She had, explicitly asked me to get in touch with my love of folk music and pop music as I was writing that.
Shara or the playwright?
No, Ellen.
Okay.
Ellen did. So I should say, first of all, that what I wrote in Penelope was a huge break from what I'd been writing at Yale. Like, it was aesthetically, you know, I would not have felt comfortable writing Penelope while I was at Yale or while I was studying with Justin. So it was hard for me to start writing Penelope. Like Ellen said, sorry, I should back up for a second. Because Ellen was going to be singing it, it needed to be music that she could sing by ear, that she could learn by ear, because Ellen doesn't read. Mm-hmm. So read music. So so I, you know, set out to write these songs. Also, Ellen had said, sorry, this is really confusing the way I'm describing all this.
No, this is great. It's interesting. It's interesting to just, anyway, I'm curious about how you taught it to her by rote or how she learned it, but go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. MIDI files, terrible, awful MIDI files.
Awesome.
But yeah, so she had said like, look, you're going to be writing this for me to sing. So it needs to be something I can learn by ear. She's like, but also this is a story about a very average woman, you know, a modern day Penelope who's living alone in a house by the sea, waiting for her husband to come back. She's not extraordinarily learned. She's not going to be listening. She's not going to sing in a language that's like high modernist, you know. Mm-hmm. She knew that about some of my aesthetic struggles in grad school. And she was like, I want you to tap into Joni Mitchell and, you know, all the music that you loved growing up, like folk and rock. And because this is an average, everyday woman who will just speak in a humble sort of folksy language. Mm. So that gave me this explicit license to, as she said, tap into those influences directly. But it was really, really hard to do initially. Like I sat down and I just had all the voices of my teachers on my shoulders saying, you can't use 4-bar phrases. You can't use, you know, you can't have, I don't know, that kind of repetition. You can't write a verse chorus structure.
We need to start replacing the word can't with you might want to think about. You might want to ask yourself why you're writing 4-bar phrases. Like that sets up enough of a like, here's enough rope to hang yourself. But like saying something can't do something. It's like, anyway,
the repercussions of using
4-bar phrases are way less than people want you to believe.
Right. Exactly. I know. But it's this, it's this idea that like, you're never going to have a career if you do these things, or that you're going to seem like you have terrible taste or no education, or it's such BS. But anyway, so, I have to credit my husband, Steve, because I was struggling with writing these songs and I was playing him my ideas and I was like, I can't put this down on paper. This is so simple. It's like nursery rhymes and, you know, I'm going to be blacklisted in the classical community. And he was just like, you are so full of demons and we have to exercise all these demons. And, you know, he was like, this is ridiculous. He was a really great music therapist for me at the time. So anyway, I wrote all this music and it was such a great learning experience because I realized how much I'd been repressing, you know, while I was in grad school or while I was studying with Justin. And how good it felt to be more honest in my composition and to bring in all these different influences. So I wanted to do more with that music. After the play wrapped, I wanted to do more with it. And it coincided with the time that I was starting New Amsterdam with Judd and Bill. Mm-hmm. And we were all talking about these issues a lot. Like, yeah, why do we feel like we can't do this and we can't do that? And why can't we just bring together all the music we love? If I want to write a piece, a string quartet that brings together like Herbie Hancock and, you know, Chaka Khan, like what's wrong with that? Why can't I do that? And
there was a real, just to sort of put a pin in what you're saying, like there was a real environment. I mean, this is around the time, I think, when did you write Penelope?
2008.
Right. So I had just moved to New York like a year or two before. I think you did a version of it at Galapagos.
Yeah, maybe it's 2007. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, yes. But this was also like when Ronan Giovanni was doing the Wordless Music series, was sort of becoming a thing where it was like you're pairing, you know, we opened for Flying Lotus. Like, why, you know?
Wow.
So, like, just this, there was a real push, an active push to be like, no, it's okay to put, you know, this rock band with a marimba duo.
Yeah.
And that's
totally Wordless was super.
Why is
inspiring.
This taboo? But New Am and you all were doing this similar thing. And I can't say that, I mean, I wouldn't say that So was active in that other than just being asked to play on some of those shows. But like you made a conscious effort, I think, in terms of your music. And so did Ronan in terms of the way he programmed. So I just wanted to sort of highlight that this was a unique time, especially in the New York area where
there was
a real push for it.
It was right, exactly. A lot of people were feeling the same ways. So Penelope the record kind of evolved as a dare almost from Judd and Bill. Like they came to see the play and they were like, you know, why don't you expand this? Also because there were some songs that got cut from the play. I just wanted to do more with the music. And so they're like, why don't you expand this into a record? So in the meantime, I had been listening to a lot of my Brightest Diamond records, and I didn't know Shara, but I just loved her voice. And I'd been reading interviews with her where she was describing that she had studied opera and, you know, studied, been trained as an opera singer. And so she clearly read music, and she talked about her love of classical music. So I just emailed her out of the blue and was like, you know, I am writing this series of songs. I would love to have you sing them. I have no idea if you have time or interest, but, you know, and I wrote this. I spent like days working on this email because I knew that I had like one shot.
I want students here to take, or just human beings to take a note and take a lesson from you here. Like, you just cold emailed her.
I just cold emailed her.
Right. And yeah. So there was no, I mean, not that you didn't have, like, you read the email a million times, you did all that, but there, that's what happens. That's how it works, people. Like, it's not rocket science. Like, you didn't get a grant that then paid you to call Shara. It was just like.
No, exactly. You know? And I was a nobody. I was a total nobody. I had no juice to my name whatsoever, you know? Like, you could barely find me on Google. It was like, I was so not anything. So it was really amazing, actually. It's speaks to Shara's openness to the universe, you know, that she got this email from this total rando and was like, okay, she was like, I don't know how much time I have, but you know, send me some MIDI files. And so I did that. And she wrote back and was like, wow, these are really beautiful. And she was like, I'll be in New York next week. Do you want to meet up for coffee? So we actually met at this practice room and she sang through some of the MIDI files. And I was just a puddle on the floor, just dying. I mean, she's just amazing to hear her sing this.
I've been fortunate enough to stand next to Shara a few times. And it's like Shara, Caroline, and Don Upshaw. I somehow have been blessed by the gods to stand like 2 feet from all three of them at various moments. Yeah. And I feel like with all three, the image in my head, like you say puddle on the floor. For me, I just feel like I'm standing next to a jet engine that only shoots out flowers. That's what it is.
That's amazing. Oh, like, my God, I love
the
that.
Power I'm standing right beside is so incredible.
Yeah, it's like crazy, full body goosebumps. Mm. I was like, I didn't know what to say. Yeah, so it was amazing. And we made this record together. We became really close friends. Now she's like my best friend. It's hard to imagine life without her, you know, but yeah. Cold email. So it's worth it. You know, it's worth just doing that. You have to just stick your neck out and best into it. But
how did your work, once you started working with Shara, how was your work different than it was prior? Like what was it about Shara's voice that sort of, did she push you in any way to be like, oh man, actually, man, if I got to shore up this part, or I can really use this thing I've never been able to use before. Like,
totally. I'm so glad you asked that. Cause that's actually, I think gets at the most interesting issue of this whole discussion, really, about like classical and different genres, and the way that you think about the people you're writing for really affects the music that you write, of course. So once Shara had signed on to the project, it completely changed my thinking about the songs. I like opened them up. I added new sections, you know, not just because her range could accommodate higher notes or lower notes, but like I knew that she could go places emotionally that I had in mind that classical singers wouldn't necessarily go. Mm. You know, it's a very different approach to singing. The classical sort of bel canto paradigm of singing is about aspiring to a certain technique, a certain sound. Mm-hmm. And Shara's kind of singing is this awesome otherworldly melding of all of these different genres and approaches to singing. Mm-hmm. And Shara isn't afraid to get gritty, you know, or sound dirty, or to sound even untrained if that's what the emotion calls for in a certain moment. So she's an incredible actor. And like for her, singing is kind of like just acting through her voice. And So I knew that I would be able to have this working vocabulary with her. It changed the way that I wrote the music. And then when we got into the studio, it grew even more from there. I mean, I didn't change any notes so much as like, you know, we she was just able to do things vocally and get access to different shades of emotion in the music than I even anticipated. So it really opened my eyes to the way that I think about writing for voice, because I think, especially for me as somebody who grew up loving a lot of pop and folk music, vocal writing was kind of this beast that I didn't know how to contend with. Not that I didn't know how to write for voice so much as I didn't always love classical singing. I didn't always, it felt not intimate enough, not personal enough somehow. Like I wanted the delivery to feel more intimate, more personal, the way that pop music does.
It's interesting that you bring that up. I have another question about Shara that I think is related, but when you talk about the impersonalness of classical music, classical singing, I'm speaking.
And of course, there's so much classical music singing that is totally incredibly personal. But
totally.
Yeah,
it's dumb stylist. Again, this is like going back to the conservatory and why I'm jaded about certain things. Like I never understood the wide vibrato being a necessary thing all the time. And I remember being in school and playing a piece and there was with a singer and I was like, would you mind, could you just sing it straight? And they looked at me, they're like, well, that's not how the voice works. And I was like, but Steve Reich's singers do it all the time. Like, what do you mean? That's not how the voice works. And I was like, and I think I said to them, I was like, the vibrato is so wide. I was like, I don't trust you. And they're like, what do you mean? I was like, I don't think you know where the pitch is. Like, you never sit on it. And it's like, I'm saying this, and there are singers out there just like rolling over in their graves. But I'm coming from a place of ignorance. But I will say, it being the dogma behind vibrato being a thing, just like the dogma behind the speeding up and the slowing down gesture in contemporary music also being a thing, you know, like,
yes,
like, I'm just like, why are you married to this? Why does it have to be this way? Like, in the same way, like, you can't use 4-bar phrases. It's like, well, why can't you sing Handel with a straight tone?
Yeah, right, right.
Now, if Handel has like a, like there's a napkin somewhere that he wrote on that was like, never sing my music straight tone. Fair enough. But I don't know where that is. And
yeah, you know, so, right. Of course. I mean,
it's stupid baggage is my point. Like why?
Yeah.
And well, for and sure. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. No. I was just going to say, I mean, I really don't want to sound like I'm slagging on Bel Canto. Cause like, I completely agree with you. There's some utterly gorgeous. Oh, sorry. Let me click that off here.
You're fine.
Did you hear that phone ring? Okay. Okay. So yeah, there's, you know, of course it depends on the singer. It depends on the piece. There can be, I have so many full body goosebump experiences from listening to certain bel canto singers. But yeah, for me, it often is about recognizing what the pitch is. And when you've got that really wide vibrato, that's an issue. It's also about delivery of the text and perceptibility of the text, but it's also about all of this cultural baggage that we have associated with, you know, opera music or versus pop music. And when you're wanting your music to be accessible to a certain group of people, sometimes that baggage can feel like a real, like something like a real hindrance to getting your emotion across, or to even getting someone's attention. You know, like I have friends who, you know, coming out of college, I had this group of really culturally curious friends, and we would all go to like see experimental dance and experimental film and experimental theater, but they never wanted to go see experimental music. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of times it was because they just, you know, they just didn't like the music, but a lot of times it was because they didn't like the presentation. Mm-hmm. They didn't like to see people come out in this like formal wear, or, you know, there's this association of like uptightness, you know, that I think hurts a lot of classical presentation and keeps it from reaching more ears.
And I think to give a nod to your work and to Newam, and like I mentioned Ronan with Wordless, and there's many others, but I think I don't want to say like you have an irreverence, but it's more of just a like, we're going to even this out and put these on the same playing field. And because, you know, Bach was who he was during his day. But you know who else works all the time? Billy Joel. Like that dude plays sold out shows at Madison Square Garden in a row. Like, what did Bach do? He had a gig every Sunday and he busted his butt and was like just constantly putting out rep. But I'm curious, one final question about Shara and your composing.
I feel like I didn't even answer your previous question.
No, you did.
Question.
It was totally great.
Okay.
What, the other thing that strikes me about Shara in particular is her presentation and her presence on stage. Did that affect any of the way you wrote music for her? And did it change the way the music sounded on stage and the way it looked on stage when you've got such a dynamic performer on stage? How did it change your view of your own music when you saw somebody like absolutely embodying a character in a way you never could have imagined?
Yeah. I mean, I think it made me like Shara performing Penelope made me realize that this whole world of music in my brain that I had thought couldn't exist could exist. Mm. And so creatively for me, that was a huge opening of doors and a huge opening of possibility. But seeing her, you're right, like seeing her on stage in with her physical persona, her acting, her movement, the way that she carries herself, the way she dresses, it does make you realize that all of that is a huge part of a performance, of any performance. And I knew that Shara would connect with a broader kind of audience than somebody who was wearing like a ball gown or whatever, you know, conveying this music. I mean, at this point you're dealing with like semiotics and you know, signs about culture and values. And we could talk about that forever. But I think in terms of how it affected my composition, I think it was mostly about just realizing that I could live in a space in my brain where I felt comfortable drawing from disparate traditions at the same time and putting them together. And feeling like there were people out there who would get it, performers who would get it and who could perform it and bring it to life. And that was hugely eye-opening because, you know, a lot of that music, like the next big piece that I wrote after Penelope, which did this, was Unremembered. And Unremembered began as a commission from Room Full of Teeth. And then I sort of realized that it wasn't ideally conceived for a Room Full of Teeth, and that it needed to be sung by more non-classical singers, as it were. But writing Unremembered, Unremembered is something that I would not have written if it were commissioned by the LA Phil or, you know, Orpheus Chamber Orchestra or whomever, you know, like a classical institution. It's something that when I was writing it, it was basically, I was writing it for myself. I was like, I need to hear this music. I need to get back in touch with the composer that wrote Penelope. I need to have a vehicle to express these thoughts. And so I was lucky enough to cobble together a few avenues of support for it, but it was not an institutional commission. And I think this conversation about who commissions a piece is actually really important because it really does affect the music that you create. I mean, I know you've had experiences with this with different composers as well. You know, where a composer will say, no, I don't want to write this for this label or for this, you know, supported by this grant because it'll make me go in a particular direction. You know, you want to, if you think of it as, it's interesting because we think of composers, ideally you're just writing for yourself all the time and you're just channeling your innermost truthful, authentic self, you know, but the reality is actually much different that you're, and that's not necessarily a dark thing. It's like you want to please people. You want to write a piece that fits well for this performer or for this orchestra and their value system. You know, you want to meet them halfway. But you do wind up just putting on some filters that you wouldn't otherwise put on.
It's a tricky, I'm glad you brought it up. And I feel like we should schedule a whole nother podcast just to talk about that. It's something I think is an important conversation, how things are commissioned, especially moving forward into this new era of whatever we're going to be dealing with as a society.
Contracts
are structured, how, you know, what a collaboration is. What is the definition of a collaboration? What is a commission? What isn't a commission? Like, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, and what can't you do during a commission? Like, this idea that, you know, we have a hard time saying no to composers. Like, as an organization, we have a hard time saying no. There are some things where, like, you know, if you came to us and were like, I want you guys to play with a 75-inch wide tam-tam, and you have to tour with it, and that's what the piece is. I mean, we need six of them, by the way. We would say, Sarah, that's awesome. Bet it sounds amazing. It's $3,000 for one, and no, we can't tour with six. Yeah. Anyway, but that's not a – you would never – that happens when you just send off a commission check and get a contract, and you never talk with the people that you're working with. It's tricky. Who's responsible? Yeah. Who gets to say what? Who gets to push in one way or another? What are your responsibilities as a commissioner? Do you get to have any say in what's written, how it's written? I don't have an answer. And I, right now in this world of the unknown, I'm very hesitant to say there should be an answer. Other than to say, I think do what you are doing, which is like, it doesn't matter what anything else is happening. I feel like what I'm hearing you say over and over again is that, you have to like what you put out. Like if you're just putting something out for somebody else, like for you, it's like you keep coming back to what you grew up on, what you like.
Yeah.
And it's fine to graft new stuff, like replanting a wine from like an old mountainside in Italy. Like you can graft a part of it off and stick it in the ground here. And it's like, you don't want to let go of that old stuff. But if at the end of the day, no matter what you're doing, if what you're about to hit send on is something you personally don't even like, I think you should not send that. And I think shouldn't put it out in the world. And I think that goes
for
any commission. Even if like the New York Phil is like, here's your commission fee and you're about to send them something that you don't like, man, you should really think about that, because that's gonna hurt you long. That may hurt you in the long run. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. But I think at this point, I could never write a piece that I can't do that anymore. I used to be able to write music that I didn't really like, but I can't do it anymore. I can't. Like, it's just, I wish I could sometimes, you know, it would make my life easier. But yeah, I think we need to encourage composers to write what they love all the time, because, you know, that's how you're going to get better. You write, the more you write, you know, being really in love with what you're doing is going to make you do it more, and that doing it more is how you get better.
The other thing too, that just to wrap up, is that I want folks to know, or to acknowledge with you all, not just you, but the new AM crew, everybody in your circle, from Shara to, I think, So Percussion, I can speak on her behalf, is like, there's many ways to go through the world, and you can constantly be pointing out what other people aren't doing, or you can do it. And I feel like, you know, like, yes, we all have baggage. We all have things that people say to us that we wish they wouldn't have said. We all get jaded by something we've seen that's not completely – fears are not rational. That's why they're fears, you know. It's not rational that every time you go in the ocean, you're worried about getting eaten by a shark. That's just not always going to be reality. So, like
I think it's rational. But anyway, no, I'm joking.
We can argue about that.
I'm really afraid of sharks.
I admire that you – put in the world what it is you want to be there. I admire that New AM does the same thing, but also I want people to understand that that's a process. You guys have been doing that for like almost 15 years now. And like, you don't get there by just deciding to do it one day. You have to do it 365 days in a row, and then do that for 15 times in a row. Like, so anyway, Sarah, I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
My door is always open as far as if you've got a new project out you want to talk about, or if you want to talk about another business thing, and we could just talk about commissioning for an hour. That'd be really fun. But
absolutely,
I appreciate your time. Where can folks find your music online?
Oh, Bandcamp. Bandcamp has all of my music. Of course, Spotify, Amazon, all the digital service provider. I mean, what am I saying? Digital service provider. Sorry, that's label speak.
Are you on AOL.com? You know, the... What's your MySpace page, Sarah?
Oh, yeah, right. Friendster. Anyway, it's all out there. And anyone should feel free to email me anytime.
Is Bandcamp your main website, or do you have another website?
I just love Bandcamp. They're okay. Just so artist friendly, and they're great. And then you can go from there and discover lots of other artists. And we're big fans of Bandcamp. We distribute all of our music through Bandcamp. But
awesome.
I think everything I've done commercially should be available there. So
okay, excellent. Well, Sarah, yeah. I thank you so much again, and I enjoy your puppy. I can't wait to meet.
Oh. Thank you. Thanks so much, Josh. It's always great to talk with you.
Likewise.
Loved
it.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. This podcast was brought to you by Liquid Drum, liquiddrum.com. Awesome content about percussion, random accessories, you name it. liquiddrum.com. Also, Small World Coffee in Princeton, New Jersey, smallworldcoffee.com. Two locations. Also, finally, not least, Kyle Dunleavy. Makes amazing steel pans. You can check them out at dunleavypans.com, dunleavypans.com. All right. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. We will talk to you soon. Take care. Bye.